SoakedInBleachTheMovie.com. That's what we're talking about tonight. CobainCase.com. Those are the two websites you need to go educate yourself with and start to research, look into, and start to question what's going on out there. Should we reopen this case? Should it be reexamined? I think so, because there's enough, the preponderance of evidence that shows that it was not handled properly, even from the former police chief of Seattle who was in charge at the time of Kurt Cobain's death. He thinks that there was some mishandling of this case. Let's reexamine. Let's open up this case and close it once and for all so that everyone has the answers. Fans, friends, family, and we can all go to bed knowing what the reality of this case is. And there is a lot to look at, and that needs to be reexamined. One thing I mentioned at the bottom of last hour, and we got so back into this that I skipped it. When his body was found, Kurt Cobain's body was found, in April of 1994, in the greenhouse. Once you get past the fact that the electrician that found him called the radio station first to announce this, then they called the home office, and home office brought in the police, and now the body's there, and there's an ongoing investigation. The intrepid investigator who was hired by Courtney to find the body shows up on the scene during the investigation, addresses the police officer at hand and says, I need to speak to your commanding officer here because I have information that's important to this case. And of course, being a good law enforcement official, the officer goes and finds his chief, his main investigator on the case. And of course, I've got to guess, Tom, he needs to talk to you. He has to find out what you know, especially because you were in this house the day before this body was found. That also makes you possibly a suspect. We need to know who's got information. How do they greet you about that?
We were in the house just hours before the body was found. And Sergeant Cameron was the lead homicide detective who was in charge of this investigation. Mm-hmm. And like you said, I did go up to the corner of the greenhouse. Now, this is the first time we were there during the day. And, of course, the police had the driveway blocked, and they were watching the greenhouse, police officers on both corners. And I went up to one of them, and I said, I'd like to speak to the lead investigator. We were just in this house last night, and I'm sure he'd want to talk to us. And so he said, well, just a minute. And he went off to talk to Cameron. And he comes back, and he says, well, Sergeant Cameron's in charge of this, and he said just to call him at the station at 3 o'clock today. And I was just, as I said in the film, I was just dumbfounded by that. You know, you've got a dead body. I don't care what you think about how that body ended up dead. If you have somebody there that was in the house that very night, just hours before the body's found, you got to talk to that guy.
Right.
And as I said in the film, if I were the detective, I would say, hold him here. Don't let him go. If he tried to leave, I would say, handcuff him and keep him here. He's a material witness. He cannot leave this property until I talk to him. And that's where I first knew that this was going to go downhill with the Seattle detectives. Because if they were going to blow me off that easy, just call me. We'll talk on the phone. You know, I the only word I can think of is dumbfounded. And I did meet with Sergeant Cameron face-to-face a few days later, and it was the same thing, just with his hands, arms folded, looking down at me, and no matter what I said to him, it just was totally meaningless.
The documentary opens a discussion and sheds a light on the inconsistencies of the story and the timeline facing Kurt Cobain before, during, and after his death. It opens the dialogue that we need to examine these points and understand it more. Our documentarian, our filmmaker that's with us this evening, thank you for calling in and being with us. I know on the East Coast it's a lot later for you, so thank you for doing this. When we come back, Ben, I want to ask you, so that we know how this is slanted, and in all fairness to Courtney Love and other people involved in this case, why did you not involve Courtney in this documentary? Why not give her a voice and a chance to talk for herself? We'll find out about that next on Coast to Coast AM. We're back. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening. Sitting in for George Norrie, I'm Dave Schrader. Soaked in Bleach is the documentary. It's on Netflix right now. You can find it there. CobainCase.com, that's another great website run and maintained by our guest, Tom Grant, the retired private investigator and former detective with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. He personally investigated this case. not all on his own, not as some armchair quarterback trying to figure this thing out to put himself in the press. He was hired by Courtney Love to find her husband and find out what happened to her husband. This documentary, and I've been reading online, Ben, you take a lot of heat. You take a lot of heat for this documentary. And
yeah.
And the one glaring piece that's missing is giving Courtney Love the voice to come forward in this documentary and respond to the possibilities that have been raised. Why is Courtney not in this documentary?
Well, understandably, that is a point the detractors raise, and as you say, that is something that looks like it's unbalanced. But in fact, I actually invited Courtney to be interviewed for the film in December of 2013. I sent her a letter of invitation to herself and her representatives via certified mail, and unfortunately, she never got back to me until her attorney contacted me, what I believe was May of 2014. It was a cease and desist letter, basically, you know, accusing me of defamation. And I guess this was based on the first trailer for Soaked in Bleach that was released in April of 2014. So, you know, again, the detractors are always saying, you know, does this prove that Courtney killed Kurt? You know, are you defaming her or poor Courtney? And I just wish people would watch the movie for themselves and see that our conclusion is simply that Kurt deserves a just investigation. As a matter of fact, with Courtney, and people are saying, you know, is this defamatory or whatever, like her attorney was trying to imply, I'm coming from exactly the opposite place. I actually am calling for Courtney. If there's any focus on Courtney, it's for her to keep her promise she gave to Tom Grant in May of 94 to bring him a copy of the coroner's report and her friend Callie in for a polygraph. And Tom promised her if she does this, it'll all be over. And so with my goal of getting the case reopened and to give her husband a just investigation, I believe Courtney Love is the one who can lead the way, and I wish she would do that, and it will be over with for all of us.
Right. She wanted to know what happened to her husband. Where did he go? What happened to her husband? And for Frances Bean, you would think she would demand to know the answer. And again, to alleviate pressure off her own mother's shoulders. And if they came forward and just said, this needs to be reinvestigated, that would open up the floodgates and clear this up in no time, or at least give the opportunity to do that. Now let's take a look at some of the evidence in this case. You've got a dead body. You've got a missing rock star. You've got a shotgun. You've got a heroin kit neatly put away. You've got a spent shell. You've got what appears to be a suicide note. And we can break into that aspect of it as well. But a lot of these things start to point in strange directions, and they don't all add up. And let's not forget, you've got a locked door from the inside with a stool pushed up against it, according to the police talking about this, that he had barricaded himself in. Where do we go wrong on this, Tom? What's the issue? I mean, this seems from the outside, from looking at those reports from the police, this is a pretty open and shut case.
Well, and that's the way they handled it. That's the way all the Seattle authorities handled it, including the medical examiner's office. One thing you didn't mention there about what you have or what you got, you also got a private investigator who was questioning his own sanity, because I was seeing all this news media coming across. I was reading all the magazines and listening to it, and I'm thinking, you know, am I the only person in the world that can see this? You know, am I really seeing this from the proper perspective, or am I starting to lose it mentally? I questioned my own motives, my own thought process and everything. The fact that I didn't find the body. Am I doing all this because I was embarrassed that I'm not the one that found the body? You know, am I going in that direction because of that, my own ego? And I, believe me, I questioned myself over this more than any critic ever has. But I'm not somebody, like you said, sitting out in left field just reading about this in the media. I was in the very middle of this whole situation, and it wasn't just me. It was Courtney Love's own attorney, Rosemary Carroll. And we have a clip that we can play of my conversation with Rosemary Carroll. Did you want to say something?
Can you lead us a little bit? What is this conversation in regards to?
Well, I'm talking to Rosemary. Rosemary, by the way, from the very beginning, she contacted me by phone. Her office wasn't far from my office in L.A., and she wanted me to come up there. And when I went up and I walked into her room, she sat at her desk And she put her head in her hand and just shook her head back and forth. And she said, Tom, Kurt was not suicidal. He was not suicidal. And right there, that was a shock to me, because I had a feeling that she was a little uneasy with things that were going on, but I didn't think she was going to be that direct. And so our conversations continued from that point. And she wanted to work with me behind the scenes without Courtney knowing about it to find out what really happened. Now, this clip that we have is a conversation between Rosemary Carroll and I, where she's telling me she doesn't think that Kurt wrote that note that they found, that they called the suicide note.
How do you feel about the note?
I don't think he wrote it. I feel exactly the same way. He didn't write it.
Yeah.
I feel the same way I felt when I read it. He didn't write it. That doesn't mean, you know, I mean, that could mean any one of a number of things.
Right.
But I'm, in my mind, I don't think he wrote that note.
See, I
feel, not the top part of it.
Yeah, I feel the same way, although I won't be surprised if we find out that he did write it, but I still, that still doesn't necessarily mean it's a suicide note to me.
Right.
And, you know, did you read the article in Us magazine?
No.
There's an article in Us magazine that's out now on the stands. It's just mainly a one-page thing, but it's real small print. It's a pretty long article. And a picture of Kurt Cobain, a big picture. And in there's a quotation supposedly from the suicide note. And
right.
It says, I can't live my life like this any longer. Something to that effect.
Wow.
I have it right in front of me. That's not in the suicide note.
Of course not.
And the only people that have the information about what's in the suicide note, is Courtney and me and the police. You know, so they had to have gotten that from Courtney, to the best of my knowledge. And that's not a statement that's in the suicide note. But yet it's a statement that I feel she wants people to think.
Right.
Know? So, I'm at the same place. I feel that there's a possibility that this was a suicide, but
right.
Boy, when I start going through my notes and refreshing my memory about everything that's gone on and what people are saying, did you hear what Dylan is saying now?
No, I mean, I read the article.
Yeah,
but that's all. Wait, what is he saying?
He's saying that he didn't even know that the greenhouse was there. He said, after all of the times I've been up to the house, I never even knew about that room above the garage.
Such a lie.
When Duff told me that he'd made that statement, I said, oh, now, wait a second. Now, that I can tell you for sure is definitely a lie, because I turned to Dylan right after I heard on the radio where they found the body, and I said, what house above the garage? And he said, oh, that's the greenhouse. No, in fact, I said, what's the greenhouse? That's what I asked, because they said he was found in the greenhouse. What's the greenhouse? And Dylan said, oh, it's just a small room up above the garage. You know? And I said, well, why didn't we go in there? And he said, well, it's just a real small room. Last time I was up there, they just had a bunch of stuff stored in there. You know?
Wow.
I have an interesting email from one of our listeners to refresh back to a part of the story we talked about earlier, Ben, when we said that Kurt, in March, beginning of March, contacted Rosemary and said, I want a divorce. I want her out of the will.
Correct.
Did she remove her from the will?
I've heard various things on where this was. I've heard some things from various sources about what happened. Not something I feel like I'm in a place to share some of that. I think there's some things that are going to come forward yet concerning this.
Well, isn't the will a public record?
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
It hasn't been made public so far.
Yeah. Okay. It was an interesting question to go back to. All right, well, let's look at some of the other evidence. So we now have some speculation on whether or not this quote-unquote suicide note was even written by Kurt. And was it a suicide note? I mean, as a matter of fact, the bulk of the letter almost seems more like he's writing an essay on music and his relationship to it. And then the end, now, some people that have watched it and I've read some bits and pieces online, they're like, it's obviously two different styles of handwriting. I know that sometimes I'll start writing a letter, and if I start getting irritated, my handwriting changes, mm-hmm. and I might get bigger and bolder, and I underline, and I'm scoring, and I'm getting all irritated, so it might change throughout the letter, and I'll look like some kind of psycho writing this thing. So there's the possibility we can all look at the fact that maybe he did change as he was writing it because he was coming back to it. Or you start a thought, and then you come back to it, and you, oh, you know what? Daddy loves you and, you know, puts this down there. And that's a different thing because it's not part of what he wrote on top. He wants to remember this, or he has something that he wants to convey. So this, but now there's a really strange aspect to the whole note, because something's found on Courtney or in her purse. Is this correct? Her bag?
Right.
Okay, talk to me about this. How did this piece of evidence show up?
Rosemary, again, she called me. In fact, I think that's the next one up that I told you about. She said, I'd like you to come over tonight. I have something to show you.
Maybe tonight if you could come over again?
Yeah, that's fine.
There's some stuff I want to show you.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. I just there's some stuff that was left at my house that I never thought to really look at.
Yeah.
To look at it all, quite honestly, until last night.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I should tell you
that. Are they Kurt's writings?
No, hers.
Oh, okay.
So, it's her writing. And what about this standing out to you as an investigator and to Rosemary as a mutual friend, both Kurt and to Courtney?
That letter, or that one page thing that she pulled out of Courtney's backpack that Courtney had left at her house, appeared both to Rosemary and to myself to be a handwriting practice sheet where somebody, whoever originated that piece, that page, was practicing writing different letters and different styles. And both Rosemary and I perceived it that way. Whether it was or not is up for speculation.
Now a forensic handwriting analysis was done of some of the lettering on this, and it matched numerous letters to a lot of the letters that were in this handwritten note, as though it had been traced or perhaps forged.
Yeah, that's correct. And what I find interesting, too, because I agree with you, when we're writing, if we're in an emotional state, sure, our handwriting can change over time. But this letter, I feel, is a little different, and it's a little more interesting when you look. There's the body of the letter, which is distinctly different. I mean, the body is completely the same kind of handwriting, and then these final four lines are the same to each other and completely different from the body. And the body of the letter is clearly saying goodbye to the current career path, whereas the bottom four lines are saying goodbye to the world. Or it sounds that way. It's like two completely different things. If you look at the body of that one type of handwriting, you wouldn't hear anything about suicide from that. The bottom four lines could potentially indicate that.
And you would think, with an artist whose life and career was built on writing and conveying a message, and maybe I'm wrong on this, you would think that a suicide note would be a little bit more eloquent and a little bit more thoughtful. And but again, I don't know his state of mind at the time. And if you're in that fractured moment, maybe it's just broken thoughts and random bits of information coming out. Maybe he wasn't even sure at that moment he was going to commit suicide. Maybe it was just getting this out and he amped himself up. There's that possibility.
My major issue with the note, there's a lot of things that I could discuss about that note, but my major issue with that note is that it's labeled a suicide note, and there's nothing in that note that says he's killing himself. In fact, even the lines that were added, if he added those lines, could easily just as well be referring to, I'm leaving you, and you can have custody of Frances, she's better off without me, et cetera, et cetera. So there's no reason to label that as a suicide note. A note was found at the scene, period, is all the police ever should have said, and that's all that should ever be called, as a note. And to speculate that it was a suicide note is totally meaningless in my mind.
Now, the police also said that the room was barricaded from the inside, that a stool had been placed in front of the doors. Now, what I thought was funny, and we asked you off air, Ben, was the fact that did the doors open outward or open inward? Because in the documentary, it very well could have been the set design and they just didn't think it through because the doors opened outward. Did they open outward or did they open inward?
Yeah, it's my understanding that they opened outward. And furthermore, it was a push and twist type lock, as we have Tom discussing in the
movie.
Right,
which means you can do it from the inside as you're leaving and shut the door.
Exactly.
But more importantly, putting a stool in front of a door that opens the opposite direction is hardly barricading yourself in.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
And then the stool that was there pressed against the door barricading it was actually not even right up in front of the door. It was off to the side a little bit.
Yeah.
But visual.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was told by Sergeant Cameron that there was a stool wedged against the door.
Right.
But in the police report, it simply says there was a stool sitting in front of the two French doors on the other side of the greenhouse.
Well, it's simple enough, guys. There's crime photographers on site. We've got pictures. What does that tell us? We'll talk about that and so much more when we return. Stay tuned. This is the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. Everyone at Coast to Coast AM would like to welcome everybody out there, all the fathers, and wish them a very happy Father's Day. And for all of you mothers working double time as both moms and fathers, happy Father's Day, happy Parents Day to you. I want to thank my lovely children, all seven of you, for choosing me to be your dad, and thank you for making me a part of your lives. Hey, if you love what you hear right here on Coast to Coast AM 7 days a week, and you wish you could get more, there's just not enough. Well, George Noy heard you. He's got a TV show, Beyond Belief. It's a great opportunity for you to go deeper into these stories that you hear as Coast to Coast host George Noy takes dynamic discussions on paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, and all things unexplained. You can check it out at beyondbelief.com. The latest episode covers climate change and the Vatican with Daniel Sheehan. And if you'd like to try an episode, check it out for yourself free right now. The Truth on UFO Cases with Nick Pope. That's Beyond Belief with George Noy. And George has some great things coming up here soon. So if you'd like to join George, you'd like to go out and get a chance to meet your favorite overnight talk show radio host, well, then join him at the Eat and Greet Luncheon Series at the Great Greek Restaurant in Sherman Oaks, California. That's coming up June 27th. And if you'd like to attend, it's really easy. You can gather with other like-minded individuals who are interested in all the topics we cover on the show and give you a chance to meet George and some of our favorite guests. Tickets go fast, so reserve a spot right now. You can email your name and your phone number. That's your name and phone number to lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. You'll be called back with the details, and the next dates are Tuesday, June 27th, Lunch with George Noy and author-researcher Rich Martini. George also has a huge event coming up in July. There's not much time left. Get your tickets now. From radio to stage, you can enjoy the grand experience yourself from Danheiser-Wagner Entertainment when they bring the world's number one late-night talk show host to the stage. Enjoy watching the host of Coast to Coast AM, Emmy Award winner George Noy, interview some of today's brightest experts in the world of ufology, paranormal, conspiracy, and all things unexplained. It's a three-hour stage show that consists of interviews combined with video. There's music and a little singing, and that'll create an unforgettable experience for you, the theater goers and fans of the hugely popular Coast to Coast AM radio show. You can check out information about that by visiting Coast to Coast AM. .com. That's coasttocoastam.com. Click on the tab that says George, and you'll find out how to keep in touch with George, keep up with what George is doing, all of these great events, and all of the projects that he's involved in. So go check that out and make that a part of your world right now. Before we go back to break, Ben, I know it's late for you on the East Coast. You were going to check out with us here and turn the show over to Tom for the rest of the night. Would you mind staying on with us for the rest of the show? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
I'm fine. I appreciate you having us, okay. Dave. So I'm more than willing to.
Thank you. I have to address this. I've got about 10 emails referring to this character who I have no clue about at this point. And I'd like some feedback, if you don't mind. Il Duce and the $50,000 hit that Courtney reportedly, allegedly put out on Kurt Cobain. What do you know about this, and who is this character?
Yeah, I learned about that character in the same movie that I learned about Tom Grant from, and I find it significant. It's not something to be completely ignored, but I felt like Nick Broomfield did a good job covering it, and my film was never meant to replace Nick's film. So in the film, there's El Duce, if I remember correctly, he was claiming that he was offered Courtney $50,000 to whack Kurt Cobain, as he put it. So a lot of people were bringing that up during post-production when they knew Soaked in Bleach was being made, and to be honest, I did strongly consider it, even though it didn't fit the tone of the movie, and I just decided to stick to what Soaked in Bleach is, which is a docudrama, you know, the drama part being the recreations to illustrate the context of Tom Grant's investigation, which is tied tightly to his actual audio recording. So people that are saying, well, you can make anything up with that, that's just
you've got to be
true.
Ignorant if that's what you're saying about it, because
exactly.
Obviously you're helping the narrative along.
Exactly.
And by having an acclaimed actor that's portraying Tom, you know that what you're getting is something that's going to be real to life. And
precisely.
I thought that was fascinating, that you have him doing the walkthrough so we can get the visual representation of what's going on.
Thanks.
Interspersed with the actual audio, because our investigator, Tom Grant, recorded all of this and the conversation. You've got them interwoven so that they can see this, and it's not you know, let's change the words. You're just giving the narrative of this. And that made the documentary so much more fascinating to me than just more talking heads and photographs that don't move.
I appreciate that.
That is a great aspect of it. So whoever is goofy enough to complain about that aspect is nuts.
Well, I appreciate that.
Take a look for yourself. SoakedInBleachTheMovie.com. CobainCase.com. That's where you can keep up with Tom and all of the research he's doing. We've got to take a break. We'll come back. We've got more coming your way. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Thank you for joining. I am your host this evening, Dave Schrader. You're listening to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. And tonight we're discussing the Kurt Cobain suicide conspiracy. I hate to use the word conspiracy, Ben, because that denotes insanity. That denotes that there's a bunch of nuts sitting around in some basement dwelling on this, and that's not the case. We're looking at a mystery. Let's call it that, the Kurt Cobain suicide mystery.
I agree, but you know, I like that. I do too. Yeah, a lot of people, well-meaning though, they say, "Oh, it's not a conspiracy." When in fact, the term conspiracy simply means to co-inspire. It's two or more people. So, by the technical term, it is a conspiracy. But I totally appreciate what you're saying.
Right. I just not... and on saying on this show, I probably just put myself in crosshairs, and I'm not putting down the conspiracy theorist, but I just. Right. I don't want this put in the same vein as that because this is a crime. This is an actual mystery.
And a lot of people don't realize that even conspiracy alone, there are people arrested and charged every day across the country just for conspiracy. That's a crime in itself. So it's, but it's also a hot button word that everybody flips out at and just lumps into it. Everything.
You've got a crime scene investigation. You've got all of this stuff that I've talked about on hand, dead body, shotgun, famous rock star. There's got to be a million pictures about this and crime scene photographs. And there should be enough revealed in just the crime scene photographs through the Freedom of Information Act. I mean, authors are writing books all the time and getting access to gruesome pictures that they include in the book. What can we tell about this case? I mean, especially when you're saying things like the police say that the stool was barricading the door. We know that's not a fact. There's got to be a photograph of that. And again, if we can start punching enough holes in the false documentation of the police department, that in itself should cause this to reopen and reexamine a case because they're not even reporting what is physically caught on film. Where are the pictures and what do they tell us about this, Tom?
Well, when I went to Seattle the next week, you know, I came home over the weekend and then I went back up to Seattle, I think it was on Tuesday of the next week, to see Courtney again and to follow up on some things. And, of course, I went to the Seattle Police Department where I met directly with Sergeant Cameron. And that was one of the first things I asked him to see. I said, I don't need to touch them. You don't need to hand them to me or anything. I don't need copies of them. But can I just look at the crime scene photos? And he just smugly looked at me with his arms crossed again, looking down at me. And says, we didn't develop any of those. We don't develop photos at a suicide. And again, that blew me away. That didn't make any sense. Of course, you would develop the photos.
Right.
14 years or what was it when they released those in 2014? They finally released about 12 to 15.
So 20 years after the death?
Yeah. Yeah, they claim they just found them. But we also know also that they took Polaroids. In fact, I learned this as soon as we got a hold of the police reports. It mentioned in there that they had taken Polaroids. So when Cameron told me that they didn't have any developed photographs, he was lying to me again because Polaroids, you don't have to wait to be developed.
Right.
There's two things I like to add there on the photographs. Also, as Tom mentioned, they claim they've found this film. This is the film that Cobain case supporters had been begging them to develop for 20 years. And so now they're saying in the media they found it. I find that very misleading. Furthermore, another point on this, a lot of the detractors will say, oh, that's going to be, you know, harmful to people emotionally to release these photos. Why are you guys pushing for that? Nobody with Soaked in Bleach or with Tom especially is pushing for these photos to be released to the public. It's always been for these photos to be released to an independent, unbiased set of forensic experts to examine. And it's actually Wallace and Halpern's books. It's either Love and Death or Who Killed Kurt Cobain. I recall there was a coroner in that book that brought up an excellent point. He said it's the photographs of a staged suicide that can often be the slam dunk, because in this case, like if Kurt's death was in fact a staged suicide, there will often be a hand-shaped void of blood splatter on Kurt's hand. So that's one example of how important these photographs can potentially be. And obviously there's many more.
Wow. This is astounding that in this day and age, anytime in the last 20 to 25 years, this is mistakes you would expect at the turn of the century.
Right.
This, even in the 50s and 60s, maybe when they were in the infancy of real detailed CSI, maybe you could forgive what's going on at this point. But it's 1994, right? We're
right.
Deep into the 20th century and closing in quickly on the 21st century. And these glaring mistakes in police protocol beg for this case to be reopened.
Absolutely.
Right? One thing that I felt right away from my meeting with Sergeant Cameron as I left, I thought, okay, they're not going to let some PI from California come up there and make fools of them.
Right.
There's just no way.
Right.
They're never going to agree with me or accept anything I have to say because they're not going to be made fools of in their mind. And I'm telling you, if they would have taken some action and looked a little closer and treated me with a little bit of respect, I would have done nothing but praise them for the work that they were doing.
See, and I can understand the ego of law enforcement involved in this. But you know what? It wasn't pumpkin-headed Dave Schrader, who's, you know, only understanding of detective work is watching Quincy M.E., and I think I've got this theory. You're a former law enforcement official who knows this. It would only behoove, and if I'm correct on this, law enforcement employs drug addicts, prostitutes, criminals, employs them by paying them, by protecting them, in order to gain information to help better understand cases. You are a law enforcement official, retired, not pushed out of office, not because you had some kind of weird issue in your own life. It was your retirement. You took on PI as your own deal. You come forward. It would only make them look better to say, we are working with other experts in this to give us a fresh set of eyes, and this is what we found because we weren't going to give up on this case. That is a PR spin for them that, bam, is a slam dunk.
Right.
And then they look like they're geniuses because they wanted just one more set of eyes, and you were on the outside already hired by Courtney, and that would make Courtney look fantastic because she knew there was something going on, and thank God she hired Tom Grant to come in here and reinvestigate it because this is going to give even more evidence to help understand what happened to rock legend Kurt Cobain.
And when I was a detective, I would never have turned away anybody, even if it, you know, especially a former detective or police officer or experienced private investigator. We listened to anybody that wanted to tell us anything and gave them respect. We appreciated them coming in to give us information. I got nothing from them other than cold stares and No. Yeah. In fact, the last word Cameron said to me is, you haven't shown me anything that tells me this was anything other than a suicide.
So do me a favor. Listen, law enforcement are friends of our show on Coast to Coast AM and on my show, Beyond the Darkness. They love this kind of protocol. They love talking. We're not attacking law enforcement in whole. We understand there are going to be mistakes made. Officers, all I ask of you is if there's somebody that has some information that can help you do your job better and relieve the pressure off of you, please listen. Take this and use this responsibility, this gift that you've been given to protect and serve and do that job by utilizing all of the facilities that are open to you. And when you have somebody who's a seasoned veteran and a professional like this that can help you, don't turn it away. Let ego out of the way, because there's no room for ego in justice. There's only room for justice in justice and making sure that the people are protected to the best of your ability. And if that means getting help from someone else, take that help, because that makes you a better cop. And you may learn from this person in order to make yourself better on the field. And that's what your job is. So please, I just implore you to please open yourselves up to the possibility of getting help from people that know what they're doing. We've got so much to cover. I know phone lines are ringing. We're going to have questions coming in. We've covered quite a bit with the different evidence, with all the things that were hidden on this, why he might have bought a shotgun, why he would be in this position. Why wasn't there fingerprints done on the shotgun? Do we understand that? Is it, again, just because of sloppy work
they
assumed it was
they
him?
They sent the shotgun in for fingerprints 30 days after the body was found. A whole month after the body was found, they sent it in for fingerprints. And yet I have a video recording of a police spokesperson saying, our detectives investigated this as a possible homicide. But yet their reports show that they didn't even send the shotgun in to get fingerprinted for 30 days after the body was found. And they'd allowed the body to be cremated within a few days. So that's not the way you investigate anything as a possible
homicide. But toxicology had already been done. They drew the blood. They're working on toxicology to know that.
But even that took a while, and yet the deputy medical examiner signed off the death certificate as a suicide before they even got the toxicology report back.
There's another reason to check this out again, because it was done out of order, not in the correct police protocol. This isn't being handled properly. It needs to be reinvestigated. But at least, okay, the body's been destroyed. There's nothing we can do. Toxicology came back, so we do have a better insight on what was going on with Kurt Cobain's body. But at least we have the evidence of the shotgun still in possession of the law at this point, right? Because this could be an important part of history and shouldn't fall into anybody else's hands.
Right.
Right? What happened to the shotgun?
Well, you know, in the film, I said that the shotgun had been melted down.
Right.
And I was wrong. I said that based on what Courtney said in something she did on TV for Mothers Against Violence.
Mm-hmm.
And in a letter, a news article that I saw from the president of Mothers Against Violence, or Against Guns, or whatever the organization was, where she also agreed that they were going to be taking the shotgun from Courtney and melting it down. That's where I got that information. When I stated it in the movie, I thought that's what happened with the shotgun. Turned out, the Seattle police come out with this photograph of Detective Szczynski holding the shotgun. So they did still have the shotgun in custody. And I'm sure he just came out with that just to make me look like I didn't know what I was talking about in the film.
But that's good news.
That one particular issue, I was wrong about that.
Right. But that doesn't mean that with all the rest of the preponderance of evidence that we should reexamine one little thread that's a little loose. The rest of it is still very cohesive. It's still holding together and is worth investigating. And phone lines are lighting up. You can email me, dave@darknessradio.com, if you have questions. We'll try to get in there. The greenhouse itself, this was the site of the crime. And even if the photographs are gone or unavailable, the shotgun's gone and unavailable. Kurt Cobain's physical form is gone and unavailable. What about the greenhouse? Is that something that can be reexamined?
No, the greenhouse was eventually torn down. I don't really have the timeline in front of me, but within the next year, I believe it was, the greenhouse was torn down. Might have been even sooner. I do have that recorded somewhere, but I haven't looked at it in so long, I can't recall when it happened. But yeah, everything is gone. The greenhouse was completely leveled and taken away. There is really no other evidence that can be used here, but there's a whole bunch of scenarios under which this case can eventually be reopened and people can be tried and prosecuted and everything. But there's... You know, that would depend on a whole bunch of different circumstances that I won't get into right now. But the fact that the physical evidence is gone does not prevent a thorough investigation and even leading to an eventual prosecution.
Of the evidence that does exist. And from the eyewitness
and
testimonies and accounts, right.
Yeah, from people.
So you've got that. I'm curious. We've got only a minute left in this segment. The recordings that you have of Courtney Love, would they be considered admissible in court?
No. No, they were taken, they were done illegally, and I knew it was illegal at the time, but I also knew that I needed to do it. Just with 2 months or so before I got the call from Courtney Love, Ben and I had come off another case where an 18-year-old girl was reported missing by her mother, and that started off with red flags too. That girl ended up dead in a dumpster 3 weeks later. So we were already at a heightened alert when dealing with a missing person. And I lost my train of thought.
Right. Well, no, that's fine. But isn't that interesting? Because if you did this illegally and you're admitting to it, that should open you to legal proceedings and lawsuits. And if Courtney Love is really bothered by what you did, it seems like she's got a slam dunk case against you.
I just knew from my first conversations with her at the hotel that we had to document everything really well. And recording was part of doing that.
All right, Tom Grant is here with us. We have documentarian Benjamin Statler on the line. We'll keep him in for the next hour. We'll open up phone calls to have you weigh in. What do you think about this? Do you have questions about this case that need to be talked about? Let's do it. When we return, I'm Dave Schrader, and you're tuned into the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM.